This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Clearly, targeting campuses was the ground in MAGA was the groundwork of Charlie Kirk, and Trump is carrying out some of that work.
Author and researcher on the fascist movement, Russ Belant, talks about the history and ideology of Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk.
The reality is San Francisco tenants want to stay in their homes, and they're going to oppose any politician that tries to get them out.
The new billionaire mayor of San Francisco, Daniel Lurie, is pushing a new so-called family zoning plan that would bulldoze rent control apartments in the city.
So all in all, the NED by itself spent about $1.6 million stirring up activism in Nepal last year to make sure a spotlight was shone on government corruption, on training Gen Z to be politically active and to encourage people to see the Chinese as the bad guys.
Has the U.S. achieved regime change in China-friendly Nepal?
I think our readership is going to be astonished by a lot of what we present in our book that's out there. It's not that it's a secret. It's just that our public institutions and our mainstream media don't talk about it.
Part two of an interview of Dr. Peter McCullough and collaborator John Leake about their new book, Vaccines, Mythology, Ideology, and Reality. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. The assassination of Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk raised the question of who he was and what his ideology is. Russ Belant, a writer and researcher on fascism and the right wing, looks at Kirk's history and ideology and corporate media and politicians' attempts to normalize these ideologies. Belant is author of The Challenge from the Religious Right, Mania in the Media, The Original Promise, and The Goals of the Promise Keepers and Old Nazis, The New Right and Republican Party. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Turning Point USA is founded in 2012 by the guy named Bill Montgomery, as well as Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk was the primarily driving force, but it was Bill Montgomery's suggestion, and he helped with the administration of setting up the organization and so forth. But Charlie Kirk was really the spark plug and the central figure throughout its history. And it was started to build right-wing conservative and far-right base on campuses across the country. And they claim now that they have organizations on 850 campuses. I think that they have some outside the United States. They operate outside the United States as well. But they basically put themselves as a base organizing element of the MAGA movement for Donald Trump. In 2016, he worked for the Trump campaign. He said Trump wasn't his ideal candidate, but after he made that statement, he started working for Trump in the campaign of 2016 and has been with them ever since, including on golf courses.
And the title, Turning Point USA, what does that mean?
It means changing the campus climate, the campus politics, and the university agendas to use students to impose demands for right-wing curricula, to monitor, report, spy on, and try to neutralize professors that they considered on the left and curriculum. And, you know, some of the stuff that Trump is doing to universities, it hasn't been credited to Turning Point. And, you know, I think it has other agendas as well. But clearly targeting campuses was the ground in MAGA was the groundwork of Charlie Kirk. And Trump is carrying out some of that work.
And this idea that the campuses are hotbeds of liberalism, radicalism, communists, was the plan to kind of purge the universities and change them into something else other than what they are?
To make them education indoctrination centers for free markets and right-wing politics, and destroying the agenda of what they called all those names, civil rights, women's rights, the efforts to try to overcome some of the legacy of racism and sexism in this country. They are for restoration of that. And Charlie Kirk himself was self-described as a Christian nationalist, which in my world is called a theocrat, somebody who believes that religion should rule the society. Christian nationalists aren't for democracy, and he's explicit. He was explicit that he was against democracy. He wanted Christian society, which meant Old Testament Christianity of the Reconstructionist sort, as I could determine. And the Reconstructionists are very present in this Trump administration, as you know.
And who funded Turning Point USA?
Bill Montgomery started with some initiatives that got several million dollars into it. And I think there's a network of billionaires that are funding it now, multi-million dollar donations, but not huge ones. It's not like the money that went to Trump, but enough to keep it going, because Charlie Kirk built a faith outreach to try to start building cells in churches across the country, as he's done on campuses across the country. He got funding for that. Turning Point USA, this was called, I think, Turning Point Faith or something like that. That they were going to try and replicate the campus model in the church world. They had several projects that they were getting funding for.
And this effort to attack transgenders, the idea that because of your sexual orientation, you're a threat to society,
yeah,
you shouldn't have equal rights. What is that all about, and where does it come from?
Well, it comes from the theocracy movement, basically. All the claims that EGGA and others make against transgender rights is based in interpretations of the Bible. Not the interpretations that says, judge not, lest ye also be judged. They don't go with that. You know, they don't go with a lot of New Testament statements, even the Sermon on the Mount. They just find what they want, and that feeds their prejudices. You know, it undermines family, you know, this and that and so forth and such. And it's, of course, shallow, transparent, evil, and mean. But it also gives them a subjective emotional appeal against the world that is not just transgender, but allows gender rights to exist and to be defended. And that, because they're going after that whole world, it's like right to life was really not about saving babies only. It was about using it as a wedge issue to undermine the Democratic Party. And that's what they're doing with transgender rights as well.
And wasn't that comparable, or what is the relationship of that to what the Nazis did in targeting homosexuals and other people in Germany?
The German Nazi model is upheld in a number of sectors of MAGA, and it reflects Donald Trump's own history. He's told people that Hitler did good things and wouldn't be persuaded that he did bad things. You'll remember that when he was in France, he said that the American soldiers that died fighting Hitler on the beaches of Normandy were losers and suckers. When he said that, that's when I think the military started turning on him back in his first term.
And one of the issues is the normalization of people like Governor Newsom had him and Bannon on his radio show. And mm-hmm. The media, the corporate media, are saying these are regular people, we should just normalize them in discussion. They're credible, and let's have a debate about him. And that's actually what Kirk said. He wanted to have debates with people. Let's just, so it's a normal part of the debate.
Yeah. Well, that gives him a base to talk to audiences he can't otherwise reach. And he was convinced of his capacity to win and persuade, charm people. And he thought any audience he gets in front of, he can take steps forward. And people accommodated that. You know, I did see where MSNBC fired somebody last night for saying that he had conducted hateful speech. He was fired for saying that last night. Maybe a week ago, he wouldn't have been fired, but he was fired for saying that last night. But the truth of the matter is, it's a matter of public record, his speech. He gave a presentation where he said that empathy was a concept created by New Agers. Of course, the New Age movement was part of the Tea Party campaign. The New Agers were part of the evil. They were the Antichrist and so forth. And he said the New Agers created empathy. So there was no empathy in human history except for the New Age. And in his world, there was no empathy. When in the Venice Film Festival, I think about a week to 2 weeks ago, there was a short 2.5-minute film documentary done on a young girl named Hain Rajab. And she was, some sources say 5, others say 6 years old. And she was calling in Palestine, she was calling the Red Crescent, the Red Cross, to send an ambulance to her family because they were being shot at by the Israeli army. And the two medics and all 5 members of her family were killed, but she was still on the phone calling them. And the documentary is the audio of her phone call. And she eventually died. Their bodies were not discovered for 12 days, but she eventually died. Charlie Kirk said Hamas is to blame for her death. Hamas is to blame for every death. And there was no responsibility and no empathy. But when this documentary was shown in Venice, there was a 23-minute ovation, the longest ovation in the Venice Film Festival history. It was a very powerful moment. This guy wasn't the kind of guy to be touched by that. He didn't care about that. He said,
"Well, the genocide that's going on now in Gaza, the pogroms that are going on in the West Bank, supported by the United States, they're Israeli Americans that go there and are involved in genocide. Are you saying that Charlie Kirk is in favor of that and just blames Hamas?"
Charlie Kirk said in print on social media that Hamas was entirely to blame for the deaths in Gaza, just like Japan was to blame for the deaths in the nuclear explosions at the end of World War II. That was Japan's fault. That's not even a fair comparison, of course. He said when one state attacks another, all the deaths are the responsibility of the attacking state. And of course, if you care about any history, the attacks on Palestinians have been ongoing for decades. But he was a Christian nationalist Zionist, and all he cared about was his side.
And of course, the Christian fundamentalists are major backers of Israel.
Yes, of course.
And supporting the expansion of Israel ideologically, yep. Politically. Yep. And there have been corporate media saying we've got to be political violence. We've got to be concerned about political violence in this country. It seems that as far as Charlie Kirk was concerned, people, they were responsible for their own deaths. I mean, because Hamas did it or something like that.
I get a little hard to talk about some of this, but I'll tell you, you know, if you see the documentary and you see in Belgium, in Brussels, there's a Hain Rajab foundation formed and her portrait is on a huge wall. And she is the most sweet looking innocent child. And to look at that picture and think that this is a deserved death, that's mental sickness. I don't care. I don't care what she believed in, you know, or was associated with. You know, you don't do that to a 5-year-old child or a 10-year-old child or, frankly, adults either. But Kirk was made statements on broadcasts that when he was talking about gun rights, that was the topic he was addressing at the university. He said in the past, we can have a few deaths by guns if that's what happens, but gun rights are more important than those deaths. And so now he suffers the death. I mentioned this also in connection with the fact that he was associated with Jack Posobiec, who would later write the book on humans that suggested that dictators who conducted mass murder, Augusto Pinochet, Francisco Franco, Chiang Kai-shek, and Ian Smith of apartheid Rhodesia in the 1970s, all of them were models of how to deal with unhumans in the United States. In other words, Prosobiec was suggesting to the MAGA movement where this book was circulated and talked about, but not in our world. Virtually nobody talks about the book on humans, but this was written by Jack Prosobiec. It was endorsed by is endorsed by J.D. Vance. It's endorsed by Donald Trump Jr., Michael Flynn, and others in Trump world. And Kirk was associated with this guy. So, you know, you're not interested at all about anybody's lives being saved. You're looking at strategic killing when you embrace those kinds of people.
And Trump is preparing to go to war, possibly with Venezuela.
And Chicago.
And Chicago, a military occupation of Chicago, other cities. They're going to hire 10,000 ICE agents and probably ideologically test them. They may be fascist Nazis, yes, that they hire as ICE agents. Yes. What's the apparatus that he's putting together and laws or executive rules that he's implementing to implement what he wants, it seems, which is a fascist, not only a fascist state, but a fascist society.
Well, on April 28th, he issued an executive order, the number is 14288, executive order. It's on the White House website. This executive order called for unleashing the police across the United States, which, of course, are controlled by local municipalities or county or state organizations, governments, and to begin plans to put troops in the streets of the United States. And he started in July 17th, he issued an executive order about using mass force to clear mentally ill and homeless people off the streets and incarcerate them and put them into cells. And of course, we know what they call detention camps and what we call concentration camps are being built with $45 billion of money under the control of ICE. But then on August 25th, he issued a follow-up executive order to create special units within every state National Guard and within the U.S. Park Service, of all places, in Washington, D.C., for special units that will be able to intervene anywhere in the United States to maintain public order. Now, what he sees as a lack of public order, many see as free speech rights. He has said that people who protest against him or his policies are committing acts of insurrection. And of course, everybody knows insurrection is a felony. And so if you're out there campaigning against Trump or his Trump world policies, and presumably at some point down the road, ICE itself, they will say that that's an insurrectionary act. You're being arrested and they're building the capacity to put you in detention centers.
That was author and researcher Russ Belant talking about the history and ideology of Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk and the executive orders that Trump is issuing. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Una mattina, I woke up early. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Una mattina, I woke up early. E ho trovato l'invasor. Partisano, take me with ya. Un bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Partisano, take me with ya. Che mi sento di morire. E se io muoio da partisano.
That was Becky G singing Bella Ciao. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. San Francisco's billionaire Mayor Daniel Lurie, an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune, is trying to push a new family zoning plan that would bulldoze rent control departments. Prior to a city hearing on the plan, tenants and their supporters protested in front of San Francisco City Hall. Fred Sherburn-Zimmer of the Housing Rights Committee spoke out about why tenants are furious with his plans.
Leave a huge percent of their housing empty. So every building we're in has lots of empty apartments. So if we want to talk about supply, we should talk about the supply that huge corporations are holding back, that are taking over the monopoly of San Francisco housing. But one housing unit isn't the same as another housing unit. A unit that has protections, a rent-controlled unit, isn't the same as a million-dollar condo. If you displace an immigrant family with kids and build something 5 years later that they may or may not be able to return to anyways, and the protections might not even be there in the first place, that kid still got moved out into two different schools. That elderly person lost their home. home where they know the person on the corner who helps take care of them. Their neighbors watch for them. They can walk, that they have a doctor who speaks their language. In this moment of Trump, we can't be evicting immigrant communities. We can't let landlords pressure transgender immigrants and other folks who are fleeing here from other parts of the country, who've lived here for a long time, who the people who painted the murals in our neighborhoods have a right to stay in the neighborhoods they helped build. And we're not, it's nice that some college graduate from Texas will have a new unit in San Francisco. But if you evict a whole building of tenants who've lived here a long time to make that happen, is that necessarily a good thing? We're not interchangeable humans. This is our homes. These are our families. Half the people doing this wouldn't do this to their mom's neighborhood or their grandma's neighborhood. Why will they do it to our family's neighborhoods?
What kind of protections would you like to see?
I would first like Weiner to get rid of the Ellis Act. He has done nothing for tenants at the state level, and he keeps saying that we should just bulldoze the housing we have and build luxury condos instead of protecting tenants. So first, I would like to see
that. That's a state law.
Yes,
right?
But this is
locally, but like in this.
But I would say this is a response. Everyone says we have to do this because of the state, but it's our representative in San Francisco who is making us do this. Like, it is not someone in the Central Valley or LA who's saying, yeah, you have to bulldoze housing. It is our state representative who is saying we should be displaced from our homes for luxury housing. Locally, we need to exempt rent control housing from this at a very minimum, because we don't get that housing back. We don't get that units back. Yes, we need to change the law so we can have rent control in more units, but at the minimum, people who have those protections, you don't get those protections back. And right now, if the building's built after 79, you don't have those basic protections. And those protections are the difference between life or death for many tenants, and definitely the difference between being able to stay here in the city, often near their jobs. You know, I was just in an entire building of restaurant workers last night, or the night before last. I was in a whole building of mostly immigrant restaurant workers, who work in this city, who are on Valencia, fighting to be able to stay in their unit, fighting against their corporate landlord relocating them. But tenants lose most of their relocation protections under this. And so you saw on a building on Mission that had a fire, they were supposed to have the right to return after a fire. We made that law so landlords didn't burn down their buildings, except that with all the state upzoning, they don't have the right to return anymore. And so they're going to rebuild that building as million-dollar condos, and none of those, I think it's 23 families, are going to be able to come back. My dad lived in a rent control unit until he died on Polk Street. I fought his landlord multiple times. I work for Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco. We work with thousands of tenants a year who are fighting to stay in their units. Mostly, we work with a whole range of tenants, including tenants in public housing. We really believe in constructing more permanently affordable housing. But this actually has a net loss of affordable housing in the future. And so this doesn't provide the housing that they went on and on about for homeless families or low-income families. There's actually nothing really that would get us more of that in this. And we'd actually lose many of our rights to fight for, that where we existingly for the last 10 years got more affordable housing. But this, what it would do is make it easier to demolish or otherwise. And even if they don't demolish the building, if an investor can potentially make more money from the next buyer by having it empty, they will, even if nothing's ever built there.
Is this part of gentrification? What's going on?
Oh, this is definitely part of gentrification. This is actually the new urban renewal. It is saying that some neighborhoods don't count and we should bulldoze them for richer, frankly, whiter communities. Like, real solutions would be getting rid of the Ellis Act, getting rid of Costa Hawkins, having stronger rent control. If we want rents not to go up, we need to make it so rents don't go up.
What about public housing? Why aren't they building public housing here in San Francisco?
We actually build more affordable housing than almost any city. That it is one of the things that we have historically, we need to do better at. But we need to think, and the state needs to fund affordable housing. is frankly what it is. Like, we work with tenants at Plaza East who actually were willing to have their homes bulldozed if they built more affordable housing that past public housing tenants who got displaced from the Western Addition got to return to. They were willing to go through that if they got to be able to not only come back, have some control over it, and to let people return. So we work with tenants all the time fighting for more housing of every type. And frankly, the federal government, the state government needs to fund affordable housing because of long-term, long-term permanently funded housing is cheaper, just like rent control is cheaper than homelessness or children who move schools all the time. Those things are really expensive. Keeping people in their homes is actually pretty cheap. And instead, we're doing it, this feels like this is just a moment for other people's profits. There's going to be a set of developers who make massive amounts of money, and we are promised a real unit in this. Some of these buildings will get one extra unit, but they'll build an office tower above it. That's allowed. You're allowed to merge units. There's lots of things that are allowed under this that aren't allowed now that are horrendous.
You think Lori is representing the developers?
I think that it is really important that San Franciscans, the reality is San Francisco tenants want to stay in their homes, and they're going to oppose any politician that tries to get them out. We're all for more affordable housing, but we are not for displacing tenants from the homes they're living in and making it easier.
That was Fred Sherburn-Zimmer of the San Francisco Housing Rights Committee at a rally in front of City Hall, talking about the gentrification plans of San Francisco billionaire mayor Daniel Lurie.
You are not a riot. You are a right-wing terror military assault upon you. You are not rebellion. You are a pretty piece of paper which is signed by murderers. You are not a riot. You are the tight leather pants on the old ex-general.
The coup. You are not a riot. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. The U.S. spent more than $1 million in Nepal recently, specifically training journalists to accuse the government of corruption and training Gen Z youth in political activism. Independent journalist Nuri Vitachi reports.
Exclusive, the real story of how an internet issue in Nepal turned into violent regime change is shocking. But it's a story you need to know to understand what's really happening in the world.
In 2023, strategists in Washington, D.C. spotted a worrying problem in Asia. A small nation, Nepal, wanted internet independence, like China had. Now, you may know that the U.S. used to sneer at what they called China's Great Firewall, seeing it as a press freedom issue. But no, that was a mistake. They realized it made a huge error. China having its own internet meant that the country could develop its own entire web ecosystem for commerce and information and everything else. And they did it really well. In fact, they did it so well that China's unique independent internet sector has been hugely successful around the world, including in the US. So TikTok beat its US rivals so badly that they all copied TikTok's style. AliExpress was selling twice as many goods as Amazon. And Shein quickly became the world's top fashion seller. Temu was the hottest thing on the net, and so on. A sovereign internet was a huge advantage, it became obvious. By 2023, the Nepalese realized they would be smart to follow China's model rather than making the error made by the Europeans, who let US global tech firms eat their lunches and their economies.
The US was horrified. What if other countries started to want the same thing? So articles started to appear saying that, oh, the Nepalese, they've got a really bad idea. So, for example, one appeared on December the 1st, 2023, saying, Nepal has a lot to gain from the open global internet, so why is the country closing the doors on it? From there, Washington DC's soft power version of the CIA, which is the National Endowment for Democracy, went into action. And so, in Nepal last year, US agents circulated reports, organized roundtable discussions, and held briefings, all with one message. China is the enemy. The US is your friend. Now, the official theme for this series of events about China was countering corruption and authoritarian influence. At the same time, US operatives organized sessions to train Nepalese reporters, local media, quote, to expose corruption and abuse of authority, publish articles to promote accountability and transparency, and hold political leaders accountable. In other words, hit hard at the government. A third group of operatives spent their time on pulling in young people or Gen Z youth. Their aim was to empower activists in promoting democratic values and human rights. US operatives provided training on using art for social and political expression. So all in all, the NED by itself spent about $1.6 million stirring up activism in Nepal last year. That's a lot of money in that country. It splashed out to make sure a spotlight was shone on government corruption, on training Gen Z to be politically active, and to encourage people to see the Chinese as the bad guys. I mean, so far, so predictable. But what made this particular US operation special was the focus on technology and communications. So the NED in February this year circulated a long and, I would say, unintentionally hilarious report called Data-Centric Authoritarianism, which purported to show how China's development of frontier technologies could globalize repression. In an astonishing feat of logical contortion, this 41-page report argued that if a country wanted to have an internet system that was free and independent of US domination, that country would become a terrible authoritarian place. You see, by this time, Pakistan and Cambodia had joined Nepal in realizing that an independent internet with control within a community's sovereign borders could be a really good idea, especially since the US had a bad reputation for transnational interference. The NED report said, Pakistan, Nepal, and Cambodia, pursuing internet gateways that will funnel all international internet traffic through a government-controlled choke point, is a win for China. How can it be a win for China, who's not involved at all? The US report said, these moves enhance China's prestige, positioning the once unique Great Firewall as a potential model for other countries worldwide. You know, it's clear that Chinese-style firewalls would be actually good for countries. But if other nations control their own information spaces, commerce spaces, this would crash Washington's all-encompassing grip over the global narrative, over the global everything. Now, Nepal pressed ahead with the tiniest of baby steps. So earlier this year, it simply asked all social media websites to register with the government. The websites had to name a local contact, an authorized person to handle grievances, and a person responsible for self-regulation. Small thing. Now, these details had to be given to Nepal's Ministry of Communications and Information Technology, deadline September the 3rd. Now, here's where things went odd. TikTok, which has a Chinese parent, was happy to sign up, and so did an app called WeTalk, and one called Viber, which I think is from an Israeli company. But the US apps, Facebook, WhatsApp, LinkedIn, and so on, refused to obey. Were they told to do that by Washington? I don't know. The Nepalese government had no choice but to follow through on what it had said by halting them. That's when the Gen Z activists went into action. In the ensuing chaos, lives were lost, property was destroyed, and the cost to Nepal, a poor country, has been enormous, reputationally and financially. It's been tragic. But think about this. The call for protests came from the media sector, the sector trained to publish anti-government articles by the NED. Is that a coincidence? The theme of the protest was to expose corruption and abuse of authority, which is exactly the theme the NED had suggested.
but of course that may also just be a coincidence. And the main participants were Gen Z youth, the exact group the NED had been training for political activism. That may also be a coincidence. And allegations are circulated saying the trouble is all China's fault, just as a series of 2024 briefings from the NED had suggested. But let's not forget the root of the problem. The Nepalese wanted an internet system of their own so they could develop their own apps, they could keep out foreign interference and have a measure of internet independence for their own people. This would have been good for the people, especially the creative young Gen Z people in Nepal, who could create their own apps for music, for commerce, for whatever. But now instead they're stuck in the US-dominated model, which of course will tell them a Western narrative, you know, West is best, rest is bad. I can give you an example. Going around people's phones right now in Nepal is a New York Times report titled "The Forces Behind Nepal's Explosive Gen Z Protests." And you know what? It chooses not to mention any of the elements I've just told you about. Not one.
That was Nuri Vitacci, host of Friday Every Day, on how the U.S. engineered regime change in Nepal. Managan, Deepak Bajracharya. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Next is part two of an interview with Dr. Peter McCullough and historian John Leake on the occasion of the publication of their newly released book, Vaccines, Mythology, Ideology and Reality. Part one of this interview aired on our September 8th show. McCullough and Leake are interviewed by Skyhorse publisher Tony Snow.
Real justification is for vaccine mandates. I mean, my view is that if they work, then the people who want them get protection and the people who don't want them take their own risk. Why is that a problem?
Well, the rationale for mandates is that no vaccine works perfectly. It's not a perfect immunization in terms of absolutely sterilizing and preventing, every single transmission. So the rationale that we're told is that vaccines can, and I think it's a theoretical proposition, but they can actually result in herd immunity, not only protection of the individual. So that's the rationale. But again, I mean, if you take the COVID-19 vaccine, what I think is fascinating is that Anthony Fauci and two of his colleagues at the NIH in 2022, so after the COVID vaccine had rolled out and after he'd relentlessly advocated it, he and his colleagues published a paper in which they acknowledged something that a famous Australian immunologist named Robert Clancy told me over dinner one night, namely, vaccines injected into the arm that induce blood antibodies are really totally ineffective against influenza and coronaviruses that rapidly replicate in the nasal passage. There's just not sufficient contact between the blood antibodies and the nasal cavity during this early period of rapid viral replication in the nose. So Dr. Clancy told me that over dinner. I thought that was rather interesting. And then about 2 months later, I read a paper by none other than Dr. Anthony Fauci and his colleagues saying the exact same thing, that blood antibody vaccines are not effective against COVID, corona, and influenza viruses. Now, the purpose of their paper was to advocate the creation of a whole new generation of products. But obviously implicit in it was his admission that the COVID-19 vaccine program that he'd so passionately and zealously advocated didn't work. I mean, we turn up many things that we present in our book. All of this is cited. The readers can look at all of the papers themselves. I think our readership is going to be astonished by a lot of what we present in our book that's out there. It's not that it's a secret. It's just that our public institutions and our mainstream media don't talk about it.
Yeah, well, anything that you're not allowed to talk about, you know, ought to make you really question what's going on. But, you know, there's so many fascinating things in this book. And I was thinking, John, maybe you can just tell us the story of Edward Jenner. Who was he? What did he invent? What's the controversy all around him? It'd be a nice story for viewers.
Well, I think Edward Jenner is a very charming character. He reminds me of somebody out of a Jane Austen novel. Jane Austen had cousins in Gloucestershire, in a Cotswold village in Gloucestershire. And she gently satirized English society of this late 18th, early 19th century period. And Jenner was an aspiring naturalist. He wrote a paper on the cuckoo, the bird, for the Royal Society. His paper on the cuckoo was published, which made him a fellow of the Royal Society. He had heard stories in Gloucestershire of dairy maids who, the story was, and it was something of a wives' tale, but it was a charming wives' tale, that dairy maids who had contracted this blister-like illness on their hands that seemed to be transferred from the udders of dairy cattle, they called it cowpox, that dairy maidens who'd had cowpox on their hands, these blisters on their hands, the perception was when smallpox came to town, as it did every now and then, the dairy maids didn't get it. So the thought was, could it be that this milder illness of cowpox rendered protection against the more virulent disease of smallpox? So what Jenner did, this idea had been going around Gloucestershire for decades, but what Jenner did was he invoked his authority as a fellow of the Royal Society, and he performed what he claimed in his paper was a challenge experiment on a little boy who was the son of his gardener, a little boy named Phipps. And he claimed that he challenged, well, he first inoculated the Phipps boy with cowpox, with the matter that he took from cowpox ulcers. So he first inoculated the little boy with cowpox, and then he subsequently gave the boy a dose of virulent smallpox. He had obtained the matter from a smallpox patient, and he claimed in his paper that it worked, that the inoculation procedure with cowpox protected the Phipps boy from smallpox. So it's a charming idea. He presents it in a paper with a lot of Latin, and it kind of is dressed up in the language of science. And the Royal Society rejected the paper, so he published it himself in a pamphlet in London. It didn't catch on at first. There were a lot of flaws in the first edition. He made a number of revisions, which we talk about in the book, which are very interesting. But a long story made short for this interview is that Jenner's pamphlet really caught on. And I use the expression a charming idea because there is something charming about it. I mean, the idea that you can take disease-causing matter that only causes a mild illness that you easily get through, and that then will protect you against a severe illness which can cause death, disfigurement, it's a lovely idea. And it's understandable why mankind became so fascinated with this idea. Our argument in the book is in this initial enthusiasm, it's almost like falling in love. You know, they say love is blind. There was a falling, mankind fell in love with this idea and subsequently became blind to the innumerable signs that it was flawed. And so what we argue in our book is it goes back to Jenner. Mankind needs to start taking the blinders off and rationally evaluating this.
That makes a lot of sense to me. So let me ask Peter one more question. And that is, what do you think would happen if there were far fewer vaccines on the vaccine schedule now? Because, you know, we've been told so many times on national television by, you know, public policy people, by senior people in Washington that that vaccines save millions of lives. So what do you think would happen if we went back to the pre-1986 kind of levels where people got 5 or 7 or 9 vaccines?
You know, the CDC published in 2024 a paper in MMWR claiming that routine childhood vaccination saved well more than a million lives. And if you go back and just count the number of deaths due to infectious diseases before a single vaccine was used, just with modern care, if you go back and count the number of polio deaths, for example, and do the math, it's mathematically impossible that vaccines save that many lives, even if they were perfect. So these are exaggerated claims based on data sometimes centuries ago, ignoring all the modern advancements in care. You know, I can tell you in terms of safety. Now, safety always trumps efficacy. And at the FDA, we always present data in terms of safety before efficacy. In terms of safety, here's some general principles. Early vaccines, and we review this in our book, have had side effects and complications, for sure. Almost all of them did. And then over time, the vaccines have become safer. And we acknowledge that. I think the polio vaccine is a good example, the injectable IPV polio vaccine. The second principle is vaccines given separately appear to be much safer than giving them in bundled combinations. That's the reason why the Japanese don't allow, for instance, giving the measles, mumps, rubella shot together. The third principle is vaccines are much safer if they're given later in life beyond the window of immunologic and neurologic development. When the baby is small and the immune system is developing and the neurologic system, there's a real opportunity to have vaccinations cause side effects. And one of the most frightening side effects for parents is a febrile seizure. That is getting a big battery of vaccines all at once. And in the United States, that could mean around the age 12 to 15 months, that could mean receiving 16 different vaccines all at once. A complication could be a febrile seizure, actually going home, high fever, and having a seizure. The CDC tells us about 3 to 4% of babies per year have a seizure. A leading cause of that is vaccination. And a critical paper by Nielsen and colleagues from Sweden, you know, examine this. And if a child has a febrile seizure of any cause, the chances of developing a neuropsychiatric disorder, having brain damage from the seizure, essentially, and that includes tics and epilepsy and attention deficit disorder and autism spectrum disorder, the chances of that composite occurring, Tony, is 40% if a febrile seizure occurs. We also know that febrile seizures in the hospital are related to apnea. That's been shown in a randomized trial recently. And if apnea occurs at home and the parents aren't there to witness it, it can result in sudden infant death syndrome. So all of these pieces are falling into place that we may have come to a breaking point on the total burden of vaccines that children are expected to endure, including ones started at the very beginning of life. So what may come from our work and the work of others, I anticipate, is a new normal where there's risk stratification. And when the risks clearly outweigh the benefits, that vaccines are given per individual for individual protection. And we give up this, you know, vaccine ideology, this aspiration of eliminating infectious diseases from the globe or protecting every single human. It is very unlikely in the future that we're going to have one size fits all and that we'll have a much more rational approach. I mean, I'll give you an example. A child born with a respiratory condition like cystic fibrosis, they may need the full battery of respiratory vaccines to you know, give them the type of protection that's warranted based on their risk. You know, whereas a child without a spleen, congenital asplenia, or if their spleen is removed due to treatment of a leukemia or lymphoma, you know, they may require certain vaccines like meningococcal, haemophilus, and pneumococcal vaccines. I mean, I strongly recommend those in my practice. But for a healthy child born today, and we have a, you know, we spend time on this in our book, a healthy child born today, in today's modern era of medicine, multiple studies show that child is healthiest if they take no vaccines whatsoever.
Tony, if I could just add something that I would draw our audience, their attention to this. It's something that we explicate very in great detail in our book. These extravagant claims that have been made for the last 30, 40 years about drastic reductions of mortality. So not morbidity. We're not talking about just the number of measles cases being reduced, but actual mortality from measles or mumps or rubella or diphtheria or whatever, any of the illnesses on the vaccine schedule. One of the things we do is we just go back and look at the U.S. vital statistics data that has been published every year for many, many decades, going all the way back to the 1930s, and you just add up the deaths that are attributed each year to these infectious diseases. And the result of this very simple data reference is that before the modern vaccine schedule was introduced, mortality from all of these diseases had reduced by way more than 90%. I mean, I'll just give you an example. This is from chapter one of the book. In the year 1946, 2 years before the era of mass vaccination began with the combined diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine, a total of 1,259 Americans died of diphtheria, 1,241 died of pertussis, and 585 died of tetanus, for a total of 3,085 deaths. Now, that's out of a nation in 1946, I think of about 150 million people. The number of car accident fatalities that year in 1946, that data is published as well, was 10 times that number. And so that putting this whole experience of infectious disease and immunization into perspective, I think our readers are going to be greatly surprised by a lot of the just published data.
That was the second half of an interview with Dr. Peter McCullough and John Leake discussing the history, science, and utility of vaccines in conjunction with the publication of their book, Vaccines, Mythology, Ideology, and Reality by Skyhorse. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.